If you've paid any attention to the U.S. economy over the past few years, you know, listened to Marketplace, read the newspaper, lived your own experience, you will have noticed a central disconnect that is at the heart of where we are today. By almost all data we measure, the economy is a lot better than it used to be. But Americans don't really feel that way. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We're going to dig into that contradiction in this episode with our poll and your stories. Plus, we spent some time with the entrepreneur who's been called the beauty guru for millennials to talk about how she's built a business. And all the stuff from South by Southwest that might be a part of your life this time next year. Come talk to us on Marketplace.org, Facebook, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. To start off the show this week, our own particular take on the news. A segment we call Long and Short. That's when we invite people on to talk about what they are bullish and bearish on in the world of business and current events. We have ESPN the magazine's senior writer, Mina Kimes, and Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan this week. Hi guys, thanks for coming on.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Since Mina is our guest, and this is your first Long and Short, I will let you go first. What are you long?
I am long skinny jeans. So, a little backstory on this. I was at a mall a few weeks ago in Dallas, which is probably the best city in America to experience a mall and get in touch with kind of what the country is feeling. And I saw all these pants that were kind of wide-legged, cropped flares, which are apparently the thing that fashion people are trying to push. And as a child of the JNCO age of the 90s, I was horrified, alarmed. So I was relieved today when I read in Bloomberg News that actually skinny jeans, 10 years strong, continue to dominate fashion. And I think more than half of all pants inventory remains skinny, which to me I just found very comforting.
I understand that. Yeah, it is a weird question or an interesting question if you are a clothing company, right? Particularly if your margins have been cut into by all of these online retailers, you're constantly trying to invent different slices of product to market. But jeans, I don't know, there are some that work and some that just don't.
Skinny jeans look good on everyone.
All right, Mina, what are you short?
I am short humanity.
Whoa.
And you might think it's because of the presidential election, but it's not. So my dismal view is based on the recent defeat of a human, the Korean Go champion Lee Sedol, I believe is how you say his name, recently lost to a computer, AlphaGo, which was invented or created by DeepMind, which is a sort of division or offshoot of Google. So Go is an incredibly complex game, and I think this is the first time that artificial intelligence or a computer has been able to match up against a human. Lee did win one match, which I, you know, celebrated a lot about, but then ultimately lost. Doesn't bode well for us.
No, it doesn't.
However, if robots are listening to this, I welcome our future overlords.
I mean, that's the flip side, right? You have to be long robots if you're short humanity.
I mean, yes, I think long robots.
I think with this Go thing, the computer program actually taught itself how to play Go. No, a human didn't even have to program it.
I find that creepy. But at the same time, we know now that Google is putting Boston Dynamics up for sale. And I love the sort of leaked emails that show that the Google PR people were sort of worried about the fact that the robots were creepy.
A little late to that
the
party.
The perception is... Right. I know. Well, I think, you know, we're all scared about that, scared of that sort of how, you know, like the robots are going to take over and the driverless car is going to careen off the cliff on its own. And obviously that's a long ways away, but there are still minor things that computer, you know, in terms of cracking codes or along the way that I do find somewhat alarming. Again, still pro robot for the record.
Fair enough.
For the record. All right, fine. Short humanity, long robots. Raghu, throw us your short, man.
I don't like kicking a company when they're down, but I'm going to short Chipotle. Ooh. Sales were down 26% in February. They ran this promotion where they gave away free burritos. I mean, if anything could save a company, it's a free burrito. 5.3 million people signed up to get a free burrito. Only 2/3 of them actually went to a Chipotle to get the free burrito. I feel like at this point, I mean, if you can't get rid of a free burrito, what can you actually?
But this is going to be probably in business schools the case study that is taught about whether or not you can recover from, you know, an E. coli crisis.
How do you recover from that? I was thinking about the other day. I was like, what would make me go to Chipotle now? And I don't know.
Particularly if part of your marketing and your brand is about kind of well-sourced ingredients, et cetera, which has always been a part of their story.
You know, the curious thing to me is Taco Bell hasn't seemed to capitalize on this moment. I was kind of cruised over to Taco Bell's Twitter to see whether they were kind of shading Chipotle. And they were instead bragging about how they invented their own burrito with a cheesy core that looked just utterly disgusting.
Know your audience, I guess.
Yeah, they're like catering to the base. I don't know.
All right, Raghu, what are you long?
So I am long the concept of March Madness. I mean, anytime I'm allowed to watch basketball at work is great. Anytime Yale is an underdog, that's great. But I have to short American productivity. One estimate says we lose about $4 billion in revenue during the season of March Madness. I think Americans have to get a little better at multitasking if we're going to keep doing this every year.
I mean, I don't want you watching.
I mean, I'm not saying I do it. I'm just saying, like, I could do it if I was allowed to do it at work. Come on, that'd be silly.
Yeah. Where do you come down on March Madness? I mean, you're a sports person.
Yes, I work for ESPN, so I am pro-March Madness, pro-sports, pro-Americans not doing their jobs and reading and watching about sports. Please continue to do that, especially on live television, which, as we know, is a thing that is, you know, somewhat in decline. So I am pro. You know, those surveys that say, they're like, oh, yeah, Americans are wasting a couple hours watching March Madness. But if they weren't, they'd be wasting them on Facebook or Twitter. So it's like, you know, are we really as productive as the surveyors think we are? I kind of doubt it.
I kind of doubt it. Also, pathetically, no one at Marketplace started a bracket this year, which just the saddest thing I've ever heard. Like, I'm embarrassed for us. Mina Kimes, Raghu Manavalan, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So I've got you on the line from South by Southwest in Austin. And I know we call it South by, right, if we're being kind of cool.
Yes.
You have this concept of it that I like as a real life tech marketplace for ideas.
I do. So this event, Lizzie, at least the tech part of it, is called Interactive. It's not really about hardware, like the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's not exclusively about software either. But what it definitely is a place where people come to bring their ideas about the present and the future of technology and exchange them.
Well, I feel like that's happening kind of all the time on the internet. What makes South by Interactive different?
What makes it different is the fact that as an event, it seems to be pretty good at predicting the future and also logging the present. Twitter launched here in 2007. Lena Dunham of the HBO show Girls arguably got her start here in 2009 with this short film called Creative Nonfiction. Last year was all about video streaming with Meerkat, if you remember. There are a lot of influential people here, and they come, go to a bunch of panels, talk a bunch, and then go back out into the world and influence the culture out in the world with the things that they've seen here.
Obviously, some of those stick and some of those don't. I mean, Meerkat is sort of fallen off the landscape.
Yes.
So what are you seeing this year?
I think the big one that seems to have arrived this year is virtual reality. But we've already talked a lot about that, and I, on Tech IRL. So we were ahead of the curve, shall we say. Another theme is that the tech industry should be tackling bigger problems, like fixing online harassment. That was a big conversation this year. Climate change. There was a session that was all about trying to fight a potential oncoming recession with data. South by Interactive is always talking about big issues, but with the president actually coming to South by Southwest to make a direct plea to tech minds here at this year's conference, it's at a new level.
Yeah. So it's also about, though, not just these kind of big global questions, but specific apps, trends, you know, things that people are out there marketing. What did you find?
Well, we actually asked other people what they were seeing, you know, the wisdom of the crowd. John Carson is with the Houston advertising agency, the Carson Group. It's his fifth year at South by Southwest.
I've heard several people talking about this app called Shorts. which seems a little creepy to me. Apparently you upload your old film roll and everyone can see it.
So the idea behind Shorts, Lizzie, is to kind of nudge you to share almost everything in your phone's camera roll.
Oh,
it's
God.
Kind of the ultimate social transparency app. And it's a little crazy, but again, some of these things sort of pop up and rise above the noise.
Wow. What else is out there?
Another person we talked with was an aspiring filmmaker. Her name is Priyanka Ghoshal. She's from Austin, and she said that one trend she's seeing is personalization.
Everyone's trying to make the new Uber like really direct to customer oriented, like food delivery or personalized bedding. I saw that downstairs, or personalized music streaming. It's like everything is becoming really personalized.
What's interesting about this idea of personalization is that as companies pull more and more data on us, they get really good at giving you things that are just for you. So this is an idea that Amazon is playing with, basically that one day you'd open up Amazon, the Amazon store, wherever you would, you know, access it. And instead of a huge list of products, you'd only be presented with like four things to buy, right? But 23andMe is also here talking about what it does in the genetic space, taking personal DNA from willing users, giving them information about their genes, but also making it so that one day, instead of antibiotics, for instance, we could potentially receive medicines made just for us based on our own singular genetic makeup.
I suspect that all of these things are going to engender another conversation between us about the balance between data and personalization and how much of ourselves we are willing to give up to have that curated experience.
That's part of our conversations for Tech in Real Life.
Yeah, Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to Tech in Real Life this week at South by Southwest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Now to that disconnect I talked about before. We got so many responses to our question about your economic anxieties that we're running them for a second week. Plus, we're going to get the results of the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Anxiety Poll. More on that in a minute. First, what you worry about. Jen Woodward is 38, owns a small business in Portland, Oregon, and her worries were pretty straightforward.
Right now, money. Not enough of it. I am the co-owner with my husband of a papermaking studio. It's called Pulp and Deckel, and we've been open for about 3.5, going on 4 years. And we teach classes, make custom paper, and have an artist residency program.
And does that cover your bills?
No, sadly it does not.
And I understand you've got a fair amount of student debt.
Yeah, I went to some fabulous schools, but sadly I've paid probably about $38,000 over the last 10 years, and I still have $77,000 to go.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, you responded to this question at sort of what's at the top of your list of worries. I guess I wonder if you could pick one thing to change, what would it be, do you think?
You know, I'm a person that tries not to regret anything and move forward. So that question is hard for me. But, you know, if I could go back and leverage some of my networking when I was in school a little bit better, when I was in grad school, that might have opened up some different doors that I didn't do enough of that.
Jen Woodward, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And then there were people like Don Funk. He's 53, lives in Bozeman, Montana, and like many Americans, he's still trying to get rid of student debt, which is not uncommon.
Well, you know, you come out of school thinking like, of course you're going to do at least as well as your parents. And then you get to this point in your life and you're like, wow, my parents are doing pretty good. But with the downturns in the economy and the lack of growth and stagnation, it seems like a lot of my generation isn't feeling the same at this age as our parents did. Many people, I think, in my generation are wondering, you know, what's next and where did it all go? And I think that's going to create a cataclysmic change in the next 20 years of how we define aging, health, healthcare, retirement.
When you think about this stuff, I know you think about your own bills and your own kind of household economics, but do you worry about the bigger picture? Do you worry about those structural changes that you're talking about?
Oh, in a really, really big way, I do. And, you know, I talk to my children and, you know, say, gosh, you know, you need to save 10%. And I'm like, well, where should they put it? You know, based on, you know, the stock market growth over the last several years and things like that. Well, if you save 10%, where would you even put it? I think about it a lot, maybe too much.
Well, Don Funk, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who wrote or left a voicemail to talk about their concerns. Next week, you might have been hearing a certain someone talk a lot about deals.
Make a deal.
Make a deal.
Make a deal.
Make the best trade deals.
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 Deal.
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 We're going to have such great deals.
A good deal maker will make great deals.
So we want to know, what's the best deal you've ever made? Maybe you made a car dealer cry, or bought in at the bottom of the stock market, negotiated a steal at the antique store. Let us know. Go to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air. We just heard from people about their personal economic anxieties, and now we're going to look at the big picture. Marketplace, in partnership with Edison Research, is conducting a series of polls this election season. Not horse race polls about the candidates, but an attempt to understand how people feel about the economy and why. Our first poll came out in October, and this week we have the second round of results. Here to run us through them is Marketplace's DC Bureau Chief, Dave Shaw. Welcome back.
Thank you, Lizzie.
What do we see in this poll? Give me the findings.
We see that people are really stressed out financially. I mean, if I had to boil it down to one sentence, that's really what we're seeing. We ask a lot of questions about how the economy feels to an individual. And so we asked people if they felt stuck, and 2 out of every 5 people said they felt stuck in their financial situation. We asked people whether or not they felt financially secure, and more than 2/3 said they were somewhat financially secure or not financially secure. We asked people about how anxious they were. 60%, more than 60%, so they were sometimes or frequently anxious about their financial situation. You know, there's a great question in here about whether people are losing sleep over their finances, and it's 30% of the folks in the survey said they were losing sleep over their financial situation. So when you look at all of those, you get a real sense of this anxiety that's permeating the American economic experience right now.
The thing that struck me when I started to look at these numbers is that they are almost exactly like the ones we got in October, the last time we did this.
What's interesting about that is that, you know, since we were last out in the field with this poll, the American economy has been adding, you know, 250,000 jobs a month on average. The Federal Reserve said, you know what, we're finally going to raise interest rates off the near zero, you know, plateau where we had been for so long, because the economy is getting stronger, because there's worries about inflation coming back, because we're starting to see some wage growth. Yet when you ask people how it feels, it feels exactly the same.
I want to dig deeper into some of the kind of subsets of data that are here, because we saw interesting things in the way the numbers fracture along gender and racial lines. Tell me about that.
Right. So if you take that economic anxiety score, you see you can compare subgroups. That's one of the things that makes it useful. And so we see that women are feeling more financial anxiety than men. African Americans and those who identified as Hispanic are feeling more economic anxiety than whites. The economic anxiety is not felt evenly across our economy and across our nation. And one of the things that we asked in the poll was how well people could handle an unexpected expense of $1,000. It's kind of striking. A quarter of the people in the survey said it would be very difficult to pay a $1,000 expense, and a third said it would be somewhat difficult. And again, those figures are higher among some subgroups, including African Americans and Hispanics. And that's something that our reporter here in D.C., Kimberly Adams, looked into.
If you're struggling to buy food or pay for childcare, even pay rent, there are services to help. But say your car breaks down or your kid chips a tooth and needs a dentist and you need cash. A lot of times, says Mersa Baradaran, you're just out of luck.
Your survey shows exactly how that comes to fruition.
Baradaran wrote a book called How the Other Half Banks, about limited financing options for the poor.
And what it means for people when they face emergencies and how thin of a financial buffer some folks have that create really, really problematic, sharp edges to their lives.
She says since so many people are living so close to the edge, one emergency expense can push them over. Baradaran says that's especially true for minorities.
African Americans and Hispanics have been left out of professional jobs for many years through racism. And also, you know, recently, I think racism is less to blame and it's more just systemic poverty.
In Los Angeles, some of the folks that need help land at a community service organization called Lyft. It directs its clients, the group calls them members, to things like housing and food assistance. Lorraine Perales works there and says a $1,000 expense would be impossible for most of them.
With our members, even with myself, I mean, that's a big amount. If they work paycheck to paycheck as is, it's a difficult thing.
Perales speaks fluent English and Spanish, catering to Lyft's many Hispanic clients. Almost three quarters of the Hispanics in our poll said it would be tough to come up with a grand. Those numbers are even worse for African Americans.
¿Y qué ahorita cómo se está sintiendo él? ¿Está en la casa?
No, está en la escuela.
¿Está en la escuela?
Sí.
38-year-old Iris Enriquez is a single mom. She has two kids and works 10 to 12 hours a day. Last year, a paperwork mix-up caused her to lose her food assistance and her job cut her hours. That put her behind on rent.
Estaba preocupada porque me iban a sacar de mi vivienda.
So she said that she was really worried because she was going to be evicted. So she tried looking for people to help her, her friends or other family members that she knew of, and they weren't able to help her for the rent.
Of the people in our poll who said it would be hard to pay an unexpected expense, half said they didn't have a friend or family member they could turn to for help. But just as Enriquez was about to be evicted, Lyft was piloting a program to provide cash for emergencies. They called around and scrounged up enough money to cover a month of rent.
Feliz. Lloré. Lloré, yeah.
So she said that she felt very, very happy. She came and she didn't know that she was going to get any help with her rental assistance, and she cried. And until now, she's still crying. So I'm a little teary myself, but so she's very happy and she's very, very grateful.
Having that place to stay let Enriquez get a second job, and now she's working on building her savings. She comes to Lyft every Thursday morning for financial counseling. But she still feels like she's barely holding on to her financial security.
Nervous. Yeah, nerviosa.
On this visit, she's worried about another unexpected expense. One of her kids broke his finger the day before, and she had to take him to the emergency room. She didn't know how much it was going to cost or how she was going to pay for it. In Los Angeles, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
So when you hear that kind of uncertainty, Dave, or the way people have to wrestle with expenses that they might not have budgeted for, whether it puts them in a precarious situation, how does all of this, or does it, translate into how they feel about the election?
So I think if you take the findings and you look at them in sort of the broadest way, you definitely get a sense of why a populist economic message could meet with success in this election cycle. Of course, we're seeing that, you know, on the Democratic side, you know, Bernie Sanders is running behind Hillary Clinton and in all likelihood will not be the Democratic nominee, but has had a very successful campaign if you consider where he was, say, 6 months or maybe a year ago. And then, of course, on the Republican side, the economic message of Donald Trump very much plays into these fears about jobs and job security and the place of the American economy in the world.
Looking forward, Dave, we've seen this remarkable continuity in the numbers in our poll, despite improving economic data. Do you have a sense that they're going to move the next time we get this batch of data?
Well, that'll be in the summer, and it'll be really interesting to see if, you know, maybe wages will increase finally in some you know, truly measurable way, and maybe that will make people feel a little bit better. But the story of the economic recovery since the recession is one of haves and have-nots, and the have-nots are still feeling economic stress. That's what this poll is showing us.
Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief Dave Shaw, who is leaving us. And we will all be brokenhearted. Thank you so much for coming on today and for everything, Dave.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Want to know how your economic anxieties compare to the people we polled? You can take our quiz at marketplace.org. No matter who you are, maybe you had a summer job you didn't exactly love, or you once bought something that, looking back, you now really regret. On this show, we invite all sorts of people to tell us how money and work played a role in their lives. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and here again is Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hello, my name is Andrew W.K., and I am a professional partier from the United States of America.
All right, first question. Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you pizza, which is synonymous, or which is as close as it needs to be for me.
When did you realize partying could be an actual career?
Well, I think in order to make something a career or profession, there has to be some sort of acceptance or agreement with the rest of the world, or a portion of the rest of the world, that this can work. They will support this. Others have to allow you to become professional at something. I mean, I guess you could pay yourself, but that wouldn't last too long. So once other people were willing to give me this chance, I realized, wow, I really am able to get away with this.
What is your most prized possession?
I'm very thankful that I've managed to somehow keep hold of this first guitar I ever got. And I'm not really a guitar player, so this doesn't actually have a lot of significance to me. It just happens to be one of the only objects that I've had since I was probably 3 years old, and I've always had it. And I didn't really even care about it very much. It's a very poor quality guitar, although I did learn how to play somewhat on it and developed my very poor quality playing through this poor quality guitar. So I guess I am fused to it in that way, although I would never blame the guitar for my poor skills. Yeah, and somehow I've just always continued to have it and have taken it with me wherever I've gone or wherever I've been. It's always been someplace in the vicinity. And it's strange because I really did not make an effort to keep track of it. It's just there, and I don't really have much connection to it other than it's the one object that I can remember having since I can even remember having thoughts at all.
What was your first job?
Well, I think the very first job that I actually got paid for that wasn't setting up a garage sale or mowing my parents' lawn or babysitting was taking over and filling in for my friend on his paper route. And the reason that was so much different than babysitting or yard work or helping out neighbors was because this involved all these strangers, these individuals that I didn't know that were relying on me to provide them with a fresh newspaper early in the morning. And it was completely overwhelming. I did a very bad job, and I never did it again.
What was the first album you ever bought?
The first album that I ever requested to be bought for me with my own, I guess, allowance that I had saved up, or just pleading to my mom to spend her money on it, was the We Are the World album. I really liked that song, still do, of course, but it made a big impact on me. My mom had bought me albums, children's music and things like that, and I did enjoy those. But I sought this one out specifically on my own, having heard this song in some capacity, probably on TV or on the radio, and said, I want that. And so we went to the grocery store at where they sold albums, and I got it.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started?
Well, actually, I was very fortunate to have the best advice given to me before I started my career, which was don't take any other people's advice too seriously.
Andrew W.K. is a musician and, yes, professional partier. Next week, and this is crazy, Carly Rae Jepsen is taking the quiz. I'm so sorry, it's such a dad joke. Ugh. There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace shows so much. Numbers are a huge part of the economic and financial world. And every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog posts the numbers in the news on our website, marketplace.org. Here are some folks from Marketplace's digital team, Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez, with this week's news, By the Numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
1.76 million.
That's how many dollars Hamilton is set to make this week, according to Playbill.
It was already a smash, and this week the cast performed at the White House.
It's a full circle moment for Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda, who first performed what would become the show's opener years ago at a White House poetry slam.
One.
That's how many of the remaining presidential candidates currently support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, President Obama's signature trade deal.
That one is John Kasich, by the way.
Trade's a hot topic in the debates, but our survey with Edison Research found a little less than half of those who responded think they know enough to decide if the deal's good or bad.
Oops.
$740 million.
That's how many dollars the NCAA will rake in this year from March Madness.
It's part of a 14-year, $10.8 billion deal with CBS and Turner for the right to broadcast the tournament.
As with most years, the cash cow is reigniting debate over player compensation and the monopoly the NCAA holds on college sports.
But for now, if you want to win your office pool, you maybe just want to have the NCAA winning the whole thing.
One of the things we do here is spend time with entrepreneurs to get a better sense of what developing and growing a business is like. Recently, we went to see Emily Weiss, the 30-year-old CEO and founder of the skincare and beauty company Glossier.
We are sitting in the Rihanna room at Glossier headquarters in Lower Manhattan. To our left is Beyonce. To our right is Madonna. Downstairs is Naomi.
So, yeah, they've got conference rooms named after female celebrities, an airy office filled with young people, and a brand, Glossier, that if you don't know about, your 20-year-old daughter probably does. Back in 2010, Weiss launched a beauty blog called Into the Gloss that became wildly popular. Then, 4 years later, came Glossier, a regimen of skincare basics aimed at young women with a kind of less is more philosophy. Glossier raised $8.4 million within 6 weeks of launching, and now Weiss is rolling out the second phase of Glossier's products.
The three products that come in yet another pink bubble pouch are a concealer. It's called Stretch Concealer because it's very elastic and it kind of moves with you and doesn't settle into any fine lines. It gives you this really, like, beautiful dewy finish. Boy Brow, which is a grooming pomade for your eyebrows. So think of it like a brow gel, except it's not crunchy or flaky or sticky or shiny.
Okay.
And then our Generation G Sheer Matte Lipstick. So that's a lipstick that comes in four shades that give you kind of like a makeout mouth, sort of like blotted look. So it's not like a bold lip. It's really more like a French girl kind of like subtle stain.
Those products are part of Weiss's expanding business. To fund it, she recruited some of the venture capitalists behind startups like Warby Parker, Birchbox, and Instacart. I asked her about the transition from running a beauty blog to running a company.
You know, I never set out to make Into the Gloss a business. With Glossier, with what the company has evolved into, or now Glossier Inc., it's very much a business. But in terms of the goal the entire time, it's always been the same, and that has never changed. And that's to, I think, really liberate women and inform women to be able to be proud of their, you know, beauty routine and their approach to beauty, and to get them really excited and take away a lot of the pain points in beauty. And the way that I met those investors is really through, I guess, just like the way anyone in New York meets anyone. It's just connections, and like, you know, I knew someone's girlfriend, and then I got a meeting, and the first meeting led to a second meeting, and one thing led to another.
There's something sort of telling in what you just said there. You knew someone's girlfriend. Was going to VCs to raise money. Were you the woman in the room?
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. Totally. I mean, and that's like not a secret. We don't dance around that. I give people so much shade, like, so the guys, because, and they laugh. I mean, it's very funny, you know, I try and kind of put things on them sometimes. Like, I'm kind of like, oh no, try this like lip balm. Come on. Or try this boy brow. I'm going to put it in your eyebrows right now at the table. And they all kind of get like a rise out of that. But, you know, I chose our partners the same way that I've chosen anyone that I've worked with over my, like, I guess, adult life, which is just who really believes what we believe and who's going to be a genuine, you know, partner, not just someone who wants to like make a quick buck, or someone who doesn't understand the power of brand. And they have the same appreciation for the consumer that I think we do, and that I've always had, because I am her. I am the consumer. So the way that we do business is very much always looking at things through, how is this going to feel to the customer? How's our girl, what's she going to think about this? And we're brutally honest about that. And our investors keep us honest.
Who is your girl?
I think she's a girl who is or aspires to be pretty knowledgeable about beauty products. I think it's a girl who's inquisitive. You know, it's a girl who has tried a lot of things and is always searching for the best. And you mentioned earlier that we're, you know, cool, or you get that vibe where it's like cool girl. I think cool is not a word that necessarily describes her. Like,
really?
Yeah. I mean, I think cool is such a fleeting thing, and to me implies
it's in your marketing copy.
Yeah.
Result of years of recommendations from the coolest girls on the planet.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing. Like, uh-huh. Everyone's cool. Like, anyone who has a great opinion about anything and is interested, you know, interested in talking, sharing her views, is a cool girl. You know, it's, you don't need to be, you know, living in New York City and have a job in fashion and be like, you know, blonde, white, and thin to be like a cool girl. You need to be a girl who's smart and who makes great choices.
Beauty is a difficult industry, in part because it is both aspirational and yet at the same time, particularly for young women, if mm-hmm. it is too aspirational, mm-hmm. you can be selling them something dangerous. I'm curious how you straddle that line. I mean, I went back and looked at your Into the Gloss wedding preparations. You went on a cleanse. You didn't eat dairy, gluten, sugar, alcohol, or coffee, which all of this
sure
sounds
didn't.
Terrible.
Yeah.
But someone might look at that and say, well, wait, what is the message that she's sending to a 17-year-old?
Totally. And I think anyone who knows me, and that means anyone who reads Into the Gloss and has read the post before, the post after, and even within that post itself, I have a green juice and I go on a cleanse for 21 days, and then next thing you know, I'm like eating a cheeseburger. Is that healthy? Like, probably not. Like, is it? But I think it's modern life. Like, it's modern.
But do you see what I'm getting at from a beauty context, where you are... Your brand is about sort of minimalism and health. And so I wonder how much time you spend thinking about this. Is like, how do we hit that sweet spot of
Glossier's about minimalism and health?
No?
No.
No? You don't think so?
No. I think it's about reflecting real life of a bunch of different women. And we talk about, I mean, for example, if you look on hashtag Glossier, within the first 30 seconds, you'll find a picture of a girl with a glass of wine masking in the bathtub. And she's like retoxing and detoxing at the same time. Because that's just, everyone aspires to be the best version of themselves, whatever that means. But at the same time, we're all human. It's just about understanding that, like, you know, we're all striving, but life is also fun. Like, don't take it too seriously. And you know, for me, I'm a beauty editor, so I tried all kinds of, I mean, that's like one of my joys in life is like, you know, getting eyelash extensions that cost like hundreds of dollars before my wedding because I want to see if I end up looking like a, you know, a reality star.
What happened?
Like, it looked good, but I wouldn't necessarily do it again, you know? And that's just my beat, but other people like, you know, do other things that are indulgences.
When you look at where you are now, who do you want to be in 5 years? Are there CEOs or founders who you think, yeah, there are things from their life where I could take a little bit of that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I love brands and I think there's a lot of talk lately about e-commerce, about digitally native brands, about all these things. But I think, you know, it's no secret that everything is going omni-channel, right? So maybe the pendulum swung the other way where now brands start on the internet and then they end up being everywhere rather than starting everywhere and then selling on the internet.
A la Amazon.
Yeah. But I think that brands are brands and that's never going to change, right? And in today's climate, I think the biggest, our biggest enemy will be the churn rate of people's attention spans, right? To newness. And if you look at the fashion industry, that's something that is really it's almost like cannibalizing itself because they're on this cycle now where they're launching like six, you know, collections a year and designers are having major burnout. And next thing you know, there's like 10 more because thanks to the internet, you can sell, you know, there can be, you know, so much newness. And so for me, I really have a lot of, you know, admiration for brands like Ralph Lauren. Brands that really have built a lifestyle over 20 plus years that are still relevant, and you've got, you know, kids in the other side of the world wanting Ralph Lauren t-shirts, you know, just because they want to be a part of that. And for that to still be relevant, I mean, think of like, you know, for kids on the other side of the world not being like, Mom, God, about Ralph Lauren is like really cool. And so I think we'd like to be a brand like that, a brand that is not a trend and is not defining a moment, but really transcends time and grows with women.
Emily Weiss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to economic anxiety in the Caribbean. Jamaica has been in a near constant state of austerity over the past few years. Stagnation, high levels of debt and crime, you name it. The country got a bailout from the International Monetary Fund a little while ago, but the borrowing conditions it imposed are very strict. There has been, though, a change of government at the start of this month, and it's possible things might be about to change. From our partners at the BBC, Nick Davis has this report.
It's just over a week since Jamaica's new Prime Minister was sworn in.
I, Andrew Michael Holness,
the country's new leader made some big election promises, which helped to swing the vote by removing income tax for those making less than $15,000, nearly three-quarters of those who currently pay, and to create 250,000 new jobs. But with a budget due later this month, and the IMF already wanting to see cuts to the wage bill, things aren't going to be smooth.
I said Jamaica motor should be no problem with a lot of problems.
With a minimum wage of just over $45 for a 40-hour week, for many people, life is hard. Barry Johnson is a mechanic with his own garage, but hears from his customers who struggle to pay him or their bills.
Yeah, well, the average person, nothing has been changed. You know, the average person will just have to fill their demands and their needs, because this is all about how Jamaica is a country that basically you get what you plant, you know.
That's you get what you plant, how yeah. Do you mean?
When I say get what you plant, whatever you want in life, you have to go for it. There's nobody here is going to give you basically a hand down.
That makes life incredibly tough. There's no safety net. There's nothing to be able to...
There's no safety or no joy just being a Jamaican. You just have to work hard, consistently hard. And your benefit will be so small. Very small. And this is the reality. It has been like this from I was a child.
So what we do is we either import or bring in locally our raw materials and we store all our raw materials there. So it comes in and it is cut. This is a cutting department where we cut by hand or we cut by the latest technology, which is CNC routers.
Mitri Siaga is the head of the Jamaica Manufacturers Association. He also runs a firm that makes commercial furnishings for companies across the region. Under the previous administration, the People's National Party, the government successfully passed 10 IMF tests in a row. He believes that the conditions are now right for growth.
I think we're now poised, and you know, we've said that very often. We're poised for growth and we're poised for this and poised for that. The truth is that the time could not be better. Oil prices are at an all-time low. Our economy is stable. Our net international reserves are where they need to be. So the appetite for investment should be rife. We think that Jamaica, brand Jamaica, has never been stronger. We have a lot of good out there in the world. If we can get our crime and justice under control, I think it will help us to rebound as we should.
Delroy Chuck is Minister of Justice. He says it's time for austerity to come to an end.
People are fed up of it, though, aren't
they? No, we are fed up of austerity, but there's no doubt we have to be fiscally prudent, because if we at any time think that government is an ATM machine that anyone can go and plug in and pull as much money as they like, we would be in danger of great disaster.
Hello, I'm Anna Chin. I am the proprietor of JoJo's Jerk Pit and More. We are all about food and experiencing Jamaica here at JoJo's.
As the food comes off giant grills, business has been good for Anna, who came home nearly 20 years ago to Jamaica after living abroad in Canada. Now, she says it'll take the whole society to help fix this problem.
We need the workforces to understand that they are a very important part in the development of this country. And if we can all work together to develop this country, we have so much to offer the world.
This is the second occasion on which Mr. Holness is being appointed Prime Minister.
The IMF programme runs until May 2017. The results of the latest test by the lender was expected this month, but delayed to allow the new government a chance to bed in. For many, they just want to see an end to the tough times. And despite the fund talking about a reduction in public debt, many don't see the benefits of it or the macroeconomic stability that's often spoken about as a success of the fund.
That's the BBC's Nick Davis. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want to hear about the best deal you've ever made. Come impress us by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Noah Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.